distribution and use of medical cannabis. However, like the federally controlled programs in Holland and the U.S., our nation's federal cannabis policy has been a source of controversy and concern since its implementation in 1999. But let's step back for a moment and begin with a brief introduction to cannabis prohibition in Canada, because although our medicinal cannabis program is administered by Health Canada, in other words, it's a health concern, it's not separate legislation from our federal drug laws, but rather it's an exemption from prosecution under the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act, which is also known as the CDSA, which outlines the laws and penalties associated with the recreational use of cannabis. Although there's a pervasive popular misconception that Canadian drug enforcement is quite lenient, that over 30,000 Canadians get charged with cannabis possession every year, and that nearly a million Canadians, that's in a population of 30 million people, have criminal records as a result of cannabis possession charges. The enforcement of cannabis prohibition costs Canadians over $340 million a year. And interestingly enough, despite leading Canada on other aspects of harm reduction, British Columbia, where I currently live and work, has more cannabis-related arrests per capita than any other province. Canadian cannabis prohibition casts a wide net, and in this climate of active enforcement, it was inevitable that legitimate medical cannabis patients would get ensnared and unjustly persecuted. In the 90s, a couple of them decided to fight back by challenging the constitutionality of our broad and indiscriminate illicit drug legislation. In 1997, Jim Wakeford was charged with cultivation for growing cannabis to treat the symptoms of his HIV/AIDS. And although the court initially denied Mr. Wakeford's request for legal protection by citing the existence of the Section 56 of the CDSA, which is a single paragraph in our Controlled Drugs and Substances Act that allows the Minister of Health to legally exempt a person or organization from persecution, a later court granted him an exemption when it was revealed that there was actually... Which brings us to Terry Parker. Terry Parker was arrested in 1997 for the cultivation and possession of cannabis, which he was using to treat severe epilepsy. In Regina versus Parker, the Section 56 exemption process was deemed unconstitutional because A, no pharmacist could actually fill a prescription for cannabis since there existed no legal source, and B, the process gave unfettered discretion related to a matter of personal liberty to the Minister of Health. The Ontario Court of Appeals declared the prohibition on the possession of cannabis to be constitutional and of no force and effect. They quite literally struck down all of cannabis prohibition in Canada, but then they suspended the declaration for 1 year's time in order to give the government time to amend the law to include adequate exemptions for medical use. The government responded by appealing the decision and then by introducing literally within the 12 hours before this decision would have struck down prohibition in Canada, they introduced the Medical Marijuana Access Regulations, or MMAR, on July 30th of 2001. There are essentially three components to Canada's federal medical cannabis program. We've got the administration, production, and research, and all of them are administered by Health Canada's Medical Marijuana Access Division, or MMAD as it's otherwise known. Let's begin with the administration of the program and the critical issue of access. The Medical Marijuana Access Regulations are intended to codify the use of medicinal cannabis within a bureaucratic regulatory approach. The stated goals are to allow compassionate access to medicinal cannabis for legitimate users and to avoid diversion to the black market. In reality, the MMAR simply outlined the arbitrary conditions under which one can avoid prosecution and arrest through an onerous and poorly considered federal application process. Let's have a look at it. Originally, there are three condition-based categories within the MMAR, all with their own specific requirements. Category one was for terminal patients. If your doctor thought that you were going to die within the next 12 months, you simply required a doctor's recommendation to access the program, which, by the way, could take up to 3 months to process. Category two was for patients with the conditions with symptomology that's generally recognized to be helped and alleviated by cannabis. That includes HIV/AIDS, MS, glaucoma, and cancer. And for those conditions, you required the recommendation of your doctor and or a specialist. And category three, that was kind of a catch-all for all other conditions, and that's where I fall in. I suffer from hepatitis C, and so hepatitis C patients, people with chronic pain and fibromyalgia, they all required the recommendation of two specialists. Now, you can imagine if you lived in a tiny town in the middle of northern BC or northern Iowa, if you tried to find two specialists to recommend cannabis for hep C, you won't even find two specialists. Ontario Court of Appeals responded to a lawsuit by medical cannabis users and distributors known as the Hitzig case by declaring the program unconstitutional once again and making four specific changes to the MMAR, including striking down the regulation that limit the number of producers allowed in one location, as well as the number of legal users per grower, while also allowing producers to be financially compensated for their work. These changes were specifically tailored by the court to allow for the community-based production and distribution of cannabis through specialized outlets like dispensaries and compassion clubs. The court also struck down the second specialist recommendation from Category 3 as arbitrary and overly onerous. In a perfect example of bad faith exhibited by the government in regards to this program, Health Canada immediately reversed this High Court decision by actually reinstating the restrictions on designated growers verbatim. They didn't even have the creativity to change the language that had been struck down by the courts. This selective interpretation of the Hitzig decision puts the program back into a very questionable constitutionality and legality, and it essentially guarantees that the work of compassion clubs and dispensaries will remain unregulated and therefore illegal. This decision is yet to be challenged in court, but it's the focus of a number of court challenges right now. So what are the specific problems with access? Although Health Canada estimates there's over 1 million Canadians currently using cannabis for medical reasons, only 1,186 patients have managed to register in the federal program over the last 5 years. Now, I just want to compare this to the Oregon state-run medical program, which over the same period of time has registered 15,000 medical users, despite having one-tenth the population of Canada. Now, this low rate of registration is largely due to an onerous application process and reluctance by physicians to act as gatekeepers for the program. Because although many GPs support the use of cannabis for certain conditions, warnings from their representative organizations like the Canadian Medical Association, the BC College of Physicians, and the Canadian Medical Protection Agency have rendered the federal program and cannabis supply all but inaccessible to most legitimate medical users. And now a little bit of background on the government's cannabis production plan and facility. And the slide that I'm showing you right now is actually how, as a medical cannabis user, you receive your cannabis. It comes in a sealed foil pouch. In December of 2000, Prairie Plant Systems, a Saskatchewan-based cultivator of fruit trees and ornamental plants, won a five-year, $5.7 million contract to produce cannabis for distribution and research by the Canadian government. They soon thereafter began cultivation of cannabis in an abandoned zinc and copper mine 500 feet below ground in Flin Flon, Manitoba. In 2005, an environmental watchdog group called the Pollution Commission for Environmental Cooperation ranked a Flin Flon smelter as the top producer of lead and mercury air pollution in all of North America. Although safeguards are apparently in place to protect cannabis production facility from these environmental contaminants, the public perception is that this is clearly a poor location to be growing anything at all, especially a medicine, to be distributed to seriously ill Canadians. Contrary to the intentions of our predecessor, Alan Rock, then Minister of Health Anne McClellan initially refused to distribute this cannabis. She cited a lack of safety and consistency with the PPS product, and until July of 2003, the MMAR was found unconstitutional by yet another court for what the court called the illusion of supply, and Health Canada is ordered to begin the distribution of this cannabis to legal exemptees. And so in August of 2003, the first few ounces of federal cannabis are sent to legal users. Less than a month after Health Canada shipped out its first package, the Vancouver Island Compassion Society had the PPS product independently tested. Now, despite being labeled 10% THC, it came in at just over 3% THC, about the same as the NIDA cannabis coming out of Mississippi. These tests are later confirmed by the Quebec Institute of Public Health Toxicology Lab, which rates the government cannabis at 5% THC on two separate tests. Additionally, extensive THC analysis conducted by Health Canada in May of 2004 showed that in over 20 tests conducted by three different labs, this product never measured above 7.2% THC, and in fact, it averaged well below 6% THC. By comparison, cannabis cultivated by the Compassion Clubs in Canada consistently comes in between 15% and 25% THC. In addition, the high levels of molds, mildews, and other biological impurities detected on this is a high world. Now, this situation has even led to criticism from our Conservative Member of Parliament. This November in the House of Commons, he stated that, and I quote, The government-run marijuana grow-op in Flin Flon, Manitoba, has been a bust. The crop has little medicinal value and may be corrupted by mine contaminants. Will the health minister shut down the operation, or will taxpayers continue to be shafted? Additionally, Health Canada has consistently ignored evidence suggesting that different strains of cannabis have different therapeutic effects, choosing instead to make only one strain available to exemptees and frustrating many end users who insist that their health conditions are not addressed by this particular cannabis product. Furthermore, although Health Canada recommends not using this medicine in smoked form, it currently offers no alternatives to loose-leaf cannabis. And by comparison, as you can see on this slide, Compassion Clubs follow a philosophy of harm reduction and of increased options for end users, and thus we offer multiple methods of ingestion, including edibles, tinctures, oils, and in some cases, even oral mucosal sprays, like the Vicks Cannabis that you see in the back of this slide. Feedback from end users of this cannabis product suggests that this long list of concerns has real merit. A Freedom of Information request has revealed that out of the original 93 exemptees who received this cannabis, nearly 30% actually returned it, physically sent it back to Health Canada. In fact, returns are so frequent that PPS now includes a cannabis products return goods authorization. However, and check this out, once the product is open, Health Canada doesn't issue refunds anymore. So this is a nonsensical policy akin to having a restaurant refuse to compensate a customer for an inadequate meal if they've actually tasted the food in question. As a result of this misguided distribution plan, it's recently been revealed that nearly half of the 278 licensed cannabis are now in arrears to our federal government for $170,000. Medical use users from this supply, which is Canada's only legal supply, effectively forcing these folks right back to the black market for their medicine. I've talked to two of these folks, and one of them has an inoperable brain tumor in the back of his eye, and the other one has a representative for payment cut off from this federal supply. And so let's move on to the government's research agenda, or more specifically, the lack of research going on in Canada. Because despite the implementation of a five-year, $7.5 million clinical cannabis research program, very little research is actually taking place in Canada. Over the last 5 years, only three federally funded clinical research protocols have been started, and one of them. And to make matters worse, I recently discovered that the Canadian Institute of Health Research suspended the entire clinical cannabis research program in June of 2004, citing that they cannot guarantee funding past 2005, and as a result, there is currently no federal funding available for clinical and 3.5 years into its mandate. By comparison, over the last few years, Compassion Clubs, like including a recently published nausea and pregnancy survey with the University of Victoria and UBC, I presented that earlier today, and additional research currently initiated or involving Compassion Clubs includes a federally funded Canadian AIDS Society study on the human rights, legal, and ethical concerns facing people living with HIV/AIDS who may wish to use patrons of Compassion Clubs, and North America's first high-THC, smoke cannabis, and chronic pain project. As we have central lecture of indifference, incompetence, and bad data, and that's why the Vicks and so many others are working to promote a medicinal cannabis program based on science, reason, and rather than fear and misinformation that currently influence these failed federal policies. But how do we get there from here? The following are five steps that would certainly help move the Canadian program in the right direction. We need an immediate audit and review of the entire federal program, and I'd suggest the U.S. program needs the same thing. We need re-implementation of the Ontario Court of Appeals changes to the MMAD. We need to re-empower the medical community by decentralizing this program to allow for immediate access to cannabis with a physician's recommendation, much as you have here in California. We need an adoption of regulations allowing for the community-based production and distribution of cannabis. And we need to urge Health Canada to follow the advice of the Senate Special Committee on Legal Drugs by establishing a cooperative relationship with Compassion Clubs and dispensaries in order to increase safe access and to advance research into the therapeutic potential of cannabis. I'd like to finish by thanking Normal and all of those who worked so hard on this conference, and all of you guys for your time, interest, and support. I look forward to your questions if we have time. Thank you very much.